This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by the Star Trek Starships Collection from Eagle Moss, the ultimate collection officially authorized by CBS Studios, featuring vessels from 50 years of Star Trek. Each is expertly sculpted, hand-painted, and comes with an authoritative collector's magazine. Start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D for only $4.95 with free shipping. For details and to order, visit st-starships.com/readyroom. And by audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. If you love podcasts, you're going to love audible.com and the ability to read your favorite books, plus those you've been wanting to get to, while on the go or at work. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more details.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 208, and this is a special edition of The Ready Room. Joining me today is my good friend Larry Nemechek, and we weren't able to do this during the week when we wanted to, but now that the weekend is here, Larry, we're able to get into The Ready Room together after all, and I'm ready to talk Star Trek Discovery news with you.
It wouldn't be hot Star Trek news post-20-something. Without hopping on a mic with
right.
You, Chris. This is, I felt an empty spot in my, any one of my Klingon or Vulcan hearts this week until we decided to do this. It just felt odd. And of course, I'm talking before I even blog.
Yeah. So. And I was evolving like Tom Paris was in Threshold. So I had two hearts and they both felt empty. And then my tongue fell out. But here I am. I've got it back in so I can talk today.
Okay, good.
So Larry, a while back when we first found out that they were going to do a new series, we hopped on and we did a quick show like this together, a special show, but we really didn't know much of anything about it. Since then, we've learned that it's called Star Trek Discovery. We got to see a little teaser. We got to see the ship. But finally, Brian Fuller has revealed quite a lot of information. So today we're going to go through, I've got 13 different points here on the outline. We're going to go through and just chat about our thoughts on these.
Yeah. When the news broke last fall, I wrote a blog piece and I said, well, here, okay. Everybody was like, just blah, 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 all over the map. And I mean, the very first one, even before Brian was connected to it. And I said, here's the five things I want to know. Here's the five questions I want to know, which included not just, you know, like everybody was all about, is it Prime? Is it JJ? What time setting? I was saying things like, I don't know where they're going to shoot it. How many episodes? Who's the showrunner? You know, and bit by bit, that's all been filled in. Unfortunately, it's Toronto. And I said at the time when Brian was announced, I didn't know how to communicate this to Star Trek universe, to Star Trek land out there, to Trek land. Is like, guys, relax, relax, relax. There's times when, I don't know, we have this love-hate affair, I guess with any huge group or following or fandom, whether it's politics or recreation or sports or whatever it is, you just can't. You can't account for everybody's tastes, and it. I know. But I'm just amazed and shocked at the people. I mean, all I'm doing is doing my best to reassure people. The minute he was hired, I said, this is the best possible thing that could happen. And everything that has come out with this show, news-wise, including our latest round of news here, has reinforced my feeling that, you know, I don't know, even know precise choices. But I mean, decisions, but just the kinds of choices that Brian is making and what we're being told is totally, totally what I'm happy with. I mean, even when I don't know what's going to happen, like with some of the things we're going to talk about here tonight, even when I don't know what's going to happen, I'm totally happy and confident in Brian's ability to do something that's fun. Because I know he was a fanboy and he's assertive enough now after having been through the mill of running some other shows that he's totally confident and has been given enough keys and enough gasoline mm-hmm. in this new car to do what he wants to do. So let's get into this. But I just want to say, since day one of all these drips of news bits announcing, that I've just been happier and happier and more confident. And it's just given me a comfort zone. And I'm sorry for the people that aren't that way, but let's talk about
that. Yeah. And he's put together a writing group of very smart writers who I think will take all of these things that we're going to talk about and put mm-hmm. together really good stories when we see it on screen. You might see it written down and it might give you pause and it might make you worried about what you're going to get, but wait till it gets on screen. And I really think this group will do well with it.
Yeah, I'm not just excited about him. I'm excited about and trusting in and confident in the conceptual choices, but also the people he's got. Or, you know, if he thinks there's a deficit in his own self, which he's a pretty fanboy. I mean, I'm just saying. I don't mean he's a
beautiful. Yeah, I was going to say, is he a pretty fanboy, Larry? What does that mean?
He is rather handsome. And the beard, I think, is added a lot. It's like Ron Moore's long Jesus hair is, you know, his you know, I think Brian's beard looks very, very
comely.
Well, he should
dye his beard blue like Ira.
No, it's been done. It's been done. They've all got to have their own look. That's come on. True. But, yeah.
You were going to say he's a pretty big fanboy, I guess, right?
Yes, yes. He is an awfully huge fanboy. No, he is a tall guy. He is a tall guy. Adjective trouble. You know what I'm trying to say. Not only are his own decisions and choices and his background incredible, but I'm reassured the people he's bringing to him to enrich the team and you know, like Kirsten Beyer, that I was talking to somebody about this, especially at Shore Leave, and a couple of people, some of her colleagues, then she couldn't be at Shore Leave. In my month of blurry conventions here, but that she was, I said, because I haven't kept, I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry, Lyra Trex and everybody, follower fans. I have not kept up with the novels. I keep up with them to an extent, but I haven't read them just because there's so much. But I know Kirsten's reputation as being able to pull details out of the background to the point where if Brian wasn't up to doing it himself, he's got her to lean on. And that was probably a big choice in having her, aside from being a great writer, even though she hasn't scripted.
And to do great things with characters.
Yes, yes, yes. But having the ability to pull back, not just like when she wrote the Voyager novels, not just from Voyager's backstory, but all across the spectrum of Star Trek canon from before. Yeah. So those are the kind of choices that he's making within his own self and the team he's putting together. That's just giving me all kinds of pause. So yeah, let's hit it. I'm sorry.
Well,
let's
jump apparently in. Not everyone shares our view, Larry, because as we jump into our first item here, I did pull one comment from the StarTrek.com article about this. All of the comments I saw were negative, but this one I felt summed them all up in one nice little package. Someone posted, "Brian Fuller, you have failed this franchise."
I just wanted to pause there. Are we, how much do we self-censor here? How many meetings have I done with you, Chris? I just want to go WTF. I love all, you know, I can be very nostalgic and I can be very sentimental. And we've said this before, but if I really wanted to time travel back to 1982 or 1986 or 2001, I just keep thinking, like every other part of civilization, that we keep progressing, you know, and people learn. There's always something in a new show or a new series or a new incarnation of Trek that maybe wasn't my first choice. I mean, my biggest problem was with the movies, but it was the basic choice of not doing original stories with a new corner of Gene's sandbox. It was going back and revisiting this and in an alternate universe. Mm-hmm. And then in hindsight, I can say, well, it was well cast. They could have just done a Hollywood reboot, but they didn't. They went to the pains of having it be an alternate universe. That's all good. It's brought a billion new fans to the franchise. That's all good.
Well, let's talk about these point by point. So the first one, we're going to start with the setting of the show, Larry. The show will take place 10 years before the original series. And let's combine it with the second one. It will focus on an incident that has been mentioned but never explored. So does this give you any clue as to what we might be getting here 10 years before Kirk's command of the Enterprise?
Well, not only is he giving you the time frame, he's telling you that a central incident mentioned but never explored is part of this. It's exactly, I mean, it's no secret. I've said for years that my first impulse in a new series would be to set it midway Kirk and Picard, because I said, I want to know what the Tomet incident was. I want to see first contact with the Cardassians. I want to see why the Romulans withdrew. I want to see the Klingons and Federation getting closer, but at the same time, the Klingons and Romulans. Romulans have withdrawn, but they're still backbiting the Klingons with, you know, Narenda 3 and Akitamer. I think that was a very, and it's far enough away that you have a lot of storytelling latitude. But this is about the same thing. It's not exactly midway Archer Kirk if it's only 10 years before the 5-year mission. And everybody immediately, I tweeted and said, well, congratulations, Brian Fuller, you just made 2254 and 22, hashtag 2254 and hashtag 2255 are now trending. But that's the literal interpretation of that because of the chronology. Yeah. But the, I mean, yeah, we have our laundry list of things people jump to on this, and some of them he knocked down in the TCA. But you know, what comes to mind first? Well, the cage, and that was exactly 10 years before, 11 years before first season. Some really funny people with a cynical sense of humor said, "Oh, Axanar."
Well, Axanar crossed my mind at first when Axanar crossed my mind when I saw the ship for the first time and the registry number was 1031. And we didn't yet know that it's 10 years before TOS, but it clearly was somewhere in that gap. And then when they mentioned, well, there's this event that happened that was referenced but never explored. And yeah, my mind went there.
That was it. But my reality mind, of all the independence and the creative freedom that Brian's given, I think a team of 47 lawyers would have knocked him down and strangled him if he'd said, "I want to set this around Axanar." Yeah. I think that was just a little too much.
So what do you think it could be? So what are some things that happened? Like, I think what it might be is, you know, in 2256, there was a huge event that took place in the lives of one of our characters. And you should know this, Larry, because you've played this character. In 2256, Dr. McCoy ended his relationship with Nancy Crater. So they could be going to find out, the Discovery's mission may be to find out what happened between Leonard and Nancy that caused the split.
Oh, Plum, we hardly knew ye. Yeah. I hate to be a doubting Thomas here on you, Chris, but I don't think that's what it's about. I don't know. I think I've got more stock in the Shellyak theory than that, and I don't have much in that either. Well, here, the entire fanboy world and girl world, everybody like immediately went to Memory Alpha, immediately dragged out their chronology books to go back and look at those years. And, you know, the Cage and the Shellyak, and people are like 54, 55, 56. But let me just throw a little monkey wrench into this. So he says the show will be set 10 years before the original series and then clarified to say the 5-year mission, which started in 65, 66. And, you know, we can be very literal here about numbers, but just as the show dating got to be and the Akutas would use as a, you know, I mean, originally the Akutas had first contact, 21, it shifted 2 years. From 51 to 53, something like that. Yeah. Or 2051 to 2053, whatever. We can round off numbers too. So he's saying 10 years before could be, you know, it could be give or take 2 or 3 years. But the bigger question is, or the bigger thing I want to point out is, the show is set 10 years before and it will focus on an incident that's never been mentioned. The incident doesn't necessarily have to have happened in that same 10 years before. The incident could have been 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years, and the characters are encountering echoes or repercussions or fallout from that original thing. And in doing so, we get back to that. So I'm just saying it doesn't have to be strictly a, you know, I know we all love to be so literal. The event he's referencing doesn't have to have happened in that same time frame.
But it is something that's been referenced on screen, he said.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But it could have been something that actually occurred, you know, with a certain amount of time before the setting of the story, and the characters are in dealing with repercussions and fallout from that event from 10 or 20 and 30.
So one thing that came to my mind in that respect would be the massacre on Tarsus IV.
That I thought of that too.
Kodos.
And look, yes, exactly. Because by the time of the original, 10 years later, it's just Kirk and Riley are the last survivors. But this is 10 years before mm-hmm. that. And knowing what a slow, methodical genius Kodos, not Caridian, Kodos, was, there could still be people alive. And it could be, I don't think the whole thing's going to be a 10 Little Indians kind of plot. But if you start looking at, I don't know, you've got these topics all detailed out here nicely. And I keep wanting to rope things in ahead of your nice, neat little list. But, not to jump ahead too much, he talked about out of the blue, but Amanda Grayson is a tangential character. And that's like, really? Okay. And not Spock, not Sarek, but Amanda. So what is that? Where does that fall in one of the 13 episodes? He likes her character. So, yeah. So anyway, it's a really wacky.
I took that. I so let's talk about that one for a minute. I know that's way down on our list of topics here, but the quote I saw was that she's not a central part of the show, but we love that character, which doesn't necessarily mean she's going to be in the show or part of the story, but just simply they really like the character. Maybe they'll find a way to get her in if it makes sense for the story.
Well, right. And Brian's all about the story. The fact that, look, this is, when I get the chance to talk to Brian, it's something that occurred to me today. Every other Star Trek, a little bit different on Enterprise because they were trying to shake things up. But every Star Trek starts with, a writer's guide Bible developed the same time as a 2-hour pilot. Well, the original series is a 1-hour, but an actual selling pilot. The other ones were all pre-sold, and the pilot was really more about launching the story than trying to be sold. They were pre-sold. But everybody, like the whoever was listed as co-creators of the show, wrote the pilot. Their names are on the pilot script. Then there's a staff, and the staff start spinning out the early stories. And usually it's a rocky start, and it takes, like it is with any show. But for some reason, Star Trek, we have to get to season 3 before anything happens.
That's true.
Original series. And this, and Enterprise, Rick and Brannon, to avert that happening, they intentionally sat down, they wrote the 2-hour pilot on Enterprise, and they had 6 scripts written before they ever cast the characters, which was like, oh my God, a new paradigm here. And, Brian was talking about, here's another point, that they haven't, they're starting to cast, but they have not cast any of the roles yet at all. And if he's got only 13 slots to fill, here's the new dynamic and paradigm at work here. And he's got this huge staff, and some of them are writing partners. So, what, everyone has an episode already? And he made the point that the style of writing is going to be, sorry, I'm jumping ahead here, the style of writing is going to be an arc of 13 shows, but each episode would be like a 13-part novel, 13-chapter novel. But each chapter would be a standalone story with a beginning, middle, and end.
Well, did he say...
So we won't be into like Dominion War blurry
arcs. That's true. But even within the Dominion War arc on DS9, you have standalone stories that do have some connections in. But did he say that every episode of the 13 is going to be a standalone story that connects, or just some of them will be? Because I thought he said that we'll have some individual stories, but they will fit into the bigger narrative, which is what you would expect from television these days anyway.
He said, with each episode being a chapter of that novel, meaning the 13-episode mm-hmm. novel, and within that chapter, there's a beginning, middle, and end.
Okay.
We will have episodes that exist by themselves, but are part of a much bigger story.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of right there.
Yeah. Well, he was sounding very inclusive, and I don't think that's the kind of thing that he has to be coy about.
Yeah.
So I think he was being, I think their structure is to have each one be a standalone and what I'm talking about are the real, I think the last gasp Dominion War stories, the season 7 last
well, the
half
final,
season
the
seven,
final 10 episodes were kind of,
yes,
nonstop.
Yeah. We're just a blur. There's like, here's 7 different levels of story going on and you're just going to get different bit. And and we're just going to come up with seven different episode titles and stick on
each
one. Yeah,
but within that, you had a few different, like you had Extreme Measures, for example, which can stand on its own quite well.
That's true. That's
really
true.
near the end. So it wasn't continuous, but it was.
The Dogs of War.
Yeah, so there were something like that.
It's like Gowron gets it, and so does Nod.
Yeah, that was going to be the original title, Larry, actually, but it wouldn't fit across the screen, and so they just shortened it to The Dogs of War. You know, Gowron is going to get it, and so is Nog, was just a little bit too long.
Oh. But yeah, so anyway, I've been amused at everybody scrambling around to micro-focus on those two or three canon years.
Yeah. Well,
insane, you know, but yeah, I'm with you. Tarsus IV came to mind first, but maybe we find out Amanda was passing through and happened to be on Tarsus IV when the executions came. I don't know.
You never know.
But
yeah.
We'll see.
Because I feel like it would be a big event, though, because I can think of some other things that happened. Like you could look at Obsession. You could look at the original encounter with that cloud, but that's not something that's worthy of, you know, sending a ship out on a mission.
Yeah,
and they're trying to explore.
Yeah, and he made the point of saying, and maybe we're jumping ahead here, that we're 10 years for the 5-year mission, Kirk's. So you've actually got Kelvin era characters at that age, mm-hmm. not that dimension. But I keep telling people, remember the Kelvin era is 10 years before the original series, so they're younger. Now they you know, Beyond creeped up a little bit there with the cut 2 or 3 years, but still. But if you did that, you would beat it 10 years. Everybody would be 10 years younger. So those characters, you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and all the rest are all running around out there somewhere, and all the guest stars and the people associated with that era. And Brian made the point of saying, yes, they're all out here. Maybe we'll do something with them, but we're going to concentrate, as he should, we're going to concentrate and focus on our own characters and our own storyline first, and then we can play with that once we're established.
Right, exactly.
You know, once our people are established.
So let's see where we are here. We talked about the setting 10 years before. We talked about the fact that it will focus on an incident that has been mentioned before but never explored. So let's talk about the main character. The lead will be a woman, but she will not be a captain. She will be a lieutenant commander. And my initial thought when I heard that was, oh, so this ship is a ship where someone who is a lieutenant commander is actually in command, kind of like Sisko was in command of the station as a commander, not a captain. But then I saw something mentioned. Fuller said, we've seen 6 characters from the captain's point of view. In order to understand something that is so completely alien from her, she must first understand herself. That's part of our journey on this planet to get along, and that's part of our journey in the first season, that this character would be trying to understand her role in what's going on. So I take it that the Discovery will have a captain, and we will see that captain, but our main character will be focused on this lead character who's a lieutenant commander. It'll be from her point of view.
And I wasn't at the TCA. I was still brain dead from recovering from Vegas and trying to get to my next con in Pensacola next week. But crazy 5-0 summer. But I'm watching people live tweet. It's really interesting too. Watching the fan press live tweet that, and watching the mundane press live tweet it. The mundane poor people were just left in the dirt. It was kind of funny, asking the fan press asking specific questions, but. My mind, the minute I saw that and that angle of it's a lieutenant commander, it's a woman, the lead is a woman, but the lead does not equal captain.
Right.
This will be a non-captain character. My mind immediately went to the original conception of the West Wing.
Okay.
Where the show is going to be about all the staff in the West Wing at the White House, and the president was barely going to be seen at all. Now, between having Martin Sheen be your actor president, you know, President Bartlett, that kind of shifted to where he was a major character equal to them. But that original intent was to show it, you know, people are saying lower decks. Well, this isn't, this is upper decks, but not center seat. So the other thing that I think, I just have a gut feeling on this maybe, and knowing Brian and knowing that it's modern times, and I think there may be a little bit of a DS9 or even an Ensign Row thing. I wouldn't be surprised if this wasn't squeaky clean time. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if, yeah, it's a lieutenant commander and it's a woman and she's not the captain, but that there's some wacky doodle, Tom Paris, Ensign Rogue kind of things aren't quite settled here. Just knowing Brian and knowing that the last thing they're going to do is do a vanilla show. Or do, you know, oh, look, it's one. You already said it. You already get that feeling. It's not just, oh, look, it's another show with here's the crew, captain, right. The doctor, the engineer, the helmsman, just roll out all the standard things, that it's going to feel very Star Trek and very Starfleet. But as far as a storytelling structure, they're going to try to do something to be very 2016, 2017 trendy. Yeah. I mean, not trendy, not trendy faddish for the sake of fad, but
in
something
step
that reflects...
with- modern storytelling.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. 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 And shake up the old format and have all the familiar pieces there. But if it is just the point of view of the lead character, that's all it needs to be. And if that is spooking people, I'm just like, come on, people.
I'm amazed
at all the years of people that wanted a Klingon saga, or they wanted this or they wanted that, which are all great ideas. I'm just like, where did you people go? Who are these people that have jumped up and are demanding a standard by the book? You know, it's like,
yeah,
relax,
I don't know how many
relax.
People.
I think it's exciting. I think it's very exciting.
I don't know how many people are really bothered by this. I've often heard over the years many people who have said that they would love to see a Lower Decks type show. If you think about the actual episode Lower Decks, that's interesting. What's life like on the ship for the average crew member? Because we always follow around, take the Enterprise D, you've got over 1,000 people on this ship, and we follow the same 7 characters around all the time. Well, you know, life has to be very, very different for everyone else. Right. So seeing something from that point of view would be interesting. The other thought I had is that I suspect that there will be fans who will be upset that although the lead is a woman, she is not captain in rank. Because I heard so many people wanting to have a female captain for this series. So even though the series is going to focus on her, is there going to be an issue for some people that she's not actually the captain of the ship? That's just a question in my mind.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. If she's got the most screen time and she's the dramatic character, it's like, people, we're not cosplaying here. We're telling stories. Yeah. And if she's the pivotal character in the middle of it all, and he said they're wanting to cast a WOC, which I saw people using, a woman of color. So, you know, and I don't know if, and not to jump here, if he said, yes, definitely there's a gay character or some kind of gender and orientation new, whatever. They were saying gay character.
I think
character.
He actually used that terminology, right? A gay character.
Yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. Yes, yes. And if that's the whole package all in one, then anyone who's boosting for that as a new landmark in diversity for Star Trek, then, you know, celebrate this. Yeah. We don't know that for sure if it's all wrapped up in the same package or not, but even having a woman and a woman of color as the lead character, celebrate that fact. And Star Trek
has always in its time has represented diversity in the crew. It just doesn't look like diversity to us when we look back at it now. But within each time period, it has pushed the envelope. And so now it's time to push the envelope again in 2017.
Yes.
And we will have characters who are more in line with the makeup of society today and with the makeup of what people see as accepted in society today. It's only natural. So it's no surprise to me at all that the lead character would be a woman, that we might have a woman of color, that we will have a gay character. This is all expected for me. And to be honest, if we didn't have these things in the series, that would really stand out as being unusual, I think, in 2017 on television, especially for a franchise known for trying to be progressive.
Progressive and that won won a multiple diversity award, you know, in 96, part of the 30th anniversary with that TV special they did.
Yeah.
They gave everyone in the cast the major producers.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
A huge TV Academy, some authority, SAG, somebody gave a big diversity award to Star Trek. But there's a couple of other wrinkles to this too that I'll wait and let us get to them when we get in the list. But it calls back to so many of these things are interrelated. I know I've jumped ship on a couple of things here, but let's keep working down our list.
So on our list, the next thing that we probably should talk about, because we just talked about characters and you already mentioned casting, is the fact that there will be a full range of alien species. We saw a photo that was tweeted out, and you know, it could be something to throw us off or it could be real, that appeared to be a makeup test for Andorians because we saw the antenna coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw someone say, this might be a trick because that doesn't really look like an Andorian. But Brian Fuller has said that they're going to be reimagining some existing alien species. So this could be their take on Andorians. But we're also going to have other aliens that we've never seen before, and possibly a lot of them, maybe like in the Kelvin timeline, Abramsverse films, we've seen more aliens than we've seen in the past because with CGI and makeup combined, it's a lot easier to put these guys on screen right now. So in the original series, the most alien we had was Spock on the ship.
Right.
And then in...
It had to be... It wasn't just a matter of creativity. It was about affordability day to day.
Right. And also... Yeah. At that point, the Federation was just coming together as well. So we know in the founding of the Federation, we have humans, we have Tellarites, we have Andorians, we have Vulcans. There are a few others, but those are the major ones.
For starters, right.
And if we're going 10 years before that, what are your expectations in terms of aliens on Discovery?
Yeah, I totally get this. I have enough confidence in Brian that he wants himself as a fanboy, and I keep using that term with all the love that I mean.
Yes, it's a term of endearment here.
A term of endearment is someone who loves the franchise. I knew, you know, I just for those who don't know or haven't heard us talk before, I met when Brian was on his first year of Voyager, which was the third or fourth season. The first time we sat down and did a year long a look back piece, which our Portal 47 people, I just gave the raw interview to them. That was our doc. That was our archive access piece that month. He had fan cred running out the wazoo. That wasn't a problem. He had pitched the story to DS9 that they keep saying DS9 and Voyager writer. Well, he sold a story on DS9. They couldn't take him on staff. They wanted him on staff. They had no room, but they said, hey, Voyager needs writers. And that's why he went over and staffed on Voyager for the years. So from the very first time we met and talked, I knew that in my bones, you could do that. The other thing it comes to mind, we're talking about stories and structure and the tone of the show, and I was going to say this, you know, Brian wrote Mortal Coil, and two or three of the episodes that year, we it wasn't a joke, it actually came up organically, but I think I said something effective, wow, all your episodes keep dealing with death in some way.
And then he went and did a show called Pushing Daisies, right?
Yes. And a show called Hannibal. And as you know, he came to that and he did that pilot for a Munsters show and Wonder Falls. And I mean, it's really a thread, humorously or devilishly, or in some way, some aspect of existence and death, you know, and coming into it or coming out of it or playing with it has kind of danced around the core more or less of a lot of the shows he's done. But anyway, way back then he was talking about, you know, he hadn't come out. I mean, I knew, but he hadn't really publicly come out gay, I don't think, to the world, not like later. He did very soon after, but he had been raised, you know, as a Catholic, and everybody of that generation who, however they were raised, quote unquote, keeping their, you know, their sexuality, their orientation in the closet, until a safe point where it wouldn't ruin their life and career and their well-being, not their fault, but just where society was. And thankfully that's just, you know, accelerated to the point now where the last 10 years have unfolded the way they have. And we have much more diversity and inclusion that way. But talking about his, all the things that, you know, and to come out as a fairly well-balanced person, you know, with his quirks, and thank God having imagination, creativity to be such an out of the box creative like he is. And all the things that he, even as a baby writer, and I say baby writer as junior staff writer on a staff where he's not only lowest guy on the pecking order, but then you've got a showrunner who is the ultimate, you know, whether that's Jerry or it's Brannon or whoever it is he's working with until he's his own showrunner, having to submerge that way. But even the instincts that he was wanting to bring up, you know, he wrote Bride of Chaotica, and the first draft of Bride of Chaotica, I mean, Brannon came up with Captain Proton, unless I'm mistaken, but Brian was thrilled to take that and run with it. And they, and it was so, it was pretty over the top, and they really pulled it. They made him pull it back for the finished show. We may have talked about this, but just a guy with that much enthusiasm and imagination and to push things. And you could tell that the first year, but the whole time with all of that, still girded with an underpinning of a love for the original series and Kirk Spock and the way that, you know, a gut level way of this is the way Star Trek is. So I've seen some people panicking. Oh my God, the Andorians are now going to be purple and the Tellarites won't be pigs. They'll be, I don't know, foxes. I don't know, foxes. Whatever it is. When we that just came up. I don't know. But aardvarks, you know,
no, that would be great if they were aardvarks.
That would be Talaxians, yeah. But my point is, when they talk about reimagining our beloved, you know, original series aliens, all he's talking about is the same thing that Mike Westmore over the years has done, is just like when we talk about redesigning the motif of Starfleet design, what has new technology allowed us to do now, you know, that they couldn't do then? It's a thing. How do you make this much, much better, but still have it evoke the original and be pretty close to the original? And, you know, when they were doing the Andorians and Tellarites, even on Enterprise, they're slightly, in fact, I think Brian in the, I got the full transcript. Brian was talking, referenced and said, some people are mad because the Andorians through all the iterations don't look exactly the way they did in Journey to Babel when they were first introduced. I think he actually mentioned that at the press conference. So the fan side of the room was right with him, and the mundane half of the room was just like lost by
the
end.
They're like, and or what? Are they still in what? The EU? Yeah, they haven't left the EU, have they? The Andorians.
The Andorians, what? They had outdoors and indoors. Yeah. But I think all he's talking about, because Brian, my God, our B writers are worse than our T aliens. Brian is enough of a fan that he doesn't want to do it himself, much less smart enough not to set half a fandom on fire. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not even about catering to the audience. It's about what he knows in his gut Star Trek is and should be. And if I sound like I'm going off out on a limb for him and off the deep end, I just know him. I was privileged enough to know him when he was, again, a baby writer. I've known the quality that he's brought to all these shows with a definite, you know, Pushing Daisies and Hannibal are two very different shows, but they both have a very strong visual look and a very strong storytelling style and a point of view. And one is quirky and one is darkly quirky and one is whimsically quirky. You know what I'm saying? And that strong sense of style, I know he will bring to the new show, but my God, he knows like no one has really ever totally screwed up a Star Trek before. And he's not about to be the first one. And he's far and away not on the top 10 list of people to be screwing up a Star Trek. So I know that upsets some people when we say, oh, that we're going to reimagine aliens. It's going to be in the best way without upsetting what we all know, because he knows he better not screw with the Tellarites. I'm excited. They might finally work in a story where somehow Tellarites are there. We get to go to Teller Prime again. I mean, you know, finally, I say again, we finally get to go to Teller Prime. So, you know, and if I get to collar him and say, you are working on a Tellarite story.
And then we go there, Larry, and we're all shocked to find out that they're actually all aardvarks.
That's right. They were, the pig-faced ones were surgically altered to fool.
Yes, the pig-faced ones, they look like pigs because of this little genetic manipulation that they did, and they tried it, and it didn't work. And
yeah, the virus, and we find out that Face of Gaming just got it wrong and did it with Klingons, exactly. Not Tellarites. All right.
Okay, so that's aliens. How do you feel about robots being in the story?
Well, that just totally less. That's the one thing. Of all the people that are upset or worried, I'm not worried, but I just want to go. In Star Trek, it's like that's such a dead end. I mean, we were talking about this on the other side of the room. When I think of robots in Star Trek, I go to the was it the Kravik and the Prelor?
Yep.
Or the Kraviks and the Kralors or the Kryons. From Prototype or the Kryons
on
or whatever.
Voyager.
Yeah, in Prototype on Voyager, and the poor actor that was stuck acting behind a bad mask on both sides of the gold and the silvers. That's my memory of robots. Although, you know, we have M4, you know, Flint's floating robot. You had another one. What was yours?
What other robots have we seen? I mean, it depends on what you count, because of course, Harry Mudd had robots in iMud.
They were androids. They were calling them androids.
The other thing, though, like if you think back in science fiction history, so the word robot comes from the story RUR, right?
Yes.
But the robots in RUR were more like androids. They were what we would call androids today. And then we shifted to this idea of having like C-3PO type robots. And then...
Or Rosie.
Yeah. Or Tweaky.
From the Jetsons. Or Tweaky. Yeah.
And then we got Data. And then we have more lifelike robots or androids, what we end up calling them. So I don't know. Like, I don't really know what they... are thinking up here in terms of there being robots. One question that I've seen asked is, if there are robots on Starfleet ships 10 years before the original series, why did we never see robots around anymore after that?
Well, and again, let's define robot.
Yeah, right. Well, in this question, I'm thinking more like C-3PO, Tweaky type robots. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where there's not an effort made to approximate a human humanoid.
Yeah, they're actually robots, kind of, or like the ones from Prototype that we were talking about.
You know, we haven't seen, and Data was built after his creator Soong, who was human. But it just dawned on me: wouldn't it be cool to see like Tellarite androids and Klingon androids, and you know, where they're like bad imitations of Juliana Tainer was pretty human, so I guess I shouldn't say bad. Look.
You would think that every society would have those, right?
Right.
As part of their development of technology, just like we're doing right now. I mean, here in Japan, you can go to the bank, and there are robots in some banks that greet you when you come in. There's a department store that has a robot android looking, but of course not in capability, a robot receptionist. So these things are becoming part of our society today. You would think that most societies would have those. Along the way.
Right. And let me step back to something. We were talking about the aliens. The thing that got me in the original series when I was too young to understand about budgets and time demands, because that's one of the reasons why I love Journey to Babel, because Journey to Babel gave me a glimpse of and made me realize that as much as I enjoyed watching the stories aboard ship and I enjoyed the characters and I enjoyed McCoy and Scotty, that this, you know, now we have the terms, we have the buzzwords that we throw around, world building, you know, and you know, the full, you know, the universe, the cinematic universe. And I love that universe, but it was almost like, okay, can we get off this ship and go see more of it? It's like, does every story have to be about this captain and this, you know, these guys on this ship? I want to go see some of the other world. And the only glimpse that we really got of this Federation beyond that was Journey to Babel and Andorians and Tellarites, which is why I've always enjoyed them. And then Andorians actually got some more screen time and the Tellarites were just, I've said that before. I'm a big underdog guy, which is, I don't really have a pig fetish or anything. I just want to see the underdogs develop, which is why I quasi became a McCoy and, you know, Scotty fan. And
well, I will tell you, Larry, that I'm pretty sure that Brian Fuller did not say that Underdog is going to be a member of the crew of the Discovery.
That's right. So maybe Sweet Polly, maybe, you know, Simon Bar Sinister could be the new alien. No, but so when we talk about diversity, Everybody always goes into, you know, all the human races and the human genders. And I would always think, well, when will diversity include having more people of alienness?
Yeah.
I don't know. And again, it's a budget thing, but we talk now about makeup as well as CG technology being more able to take that on. Just like CG opens up the storytelling, we can actually have, you know, wrecked looking ships and space battles and things and different kinds of anomalies. They don't have to be organically analog, you know, built. And maybe that means we'll have some CG'd aliens, you know. The first step on that was you know, 8472, and then two of the five, six Zindi alien species were CG'd, the aquatics and the insectoids. Yeah. You know, those were baby steps in that direction, but. Maybe that means we'll have that, or the really, you know, all the years of the bumpy headed forehead, you know, what Mike Westmore was able to do with the budget and what they asked him to do. And every once in a while, they get to do a really out of the box alien, but still they would be bipedal and all that. I, you know, the Shelyak, one of the things that, aside from the dating thing, the Shelyak was an early attempt at having something very non-humanoid. How you, and they, when Picard, you know, had the meeting when they wanted to bring up the treaty after 111 years or whatever it was, it was easy to stage that where you could have this very bulky, it was almost like a polite Armus or something there. But
oh yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. It was, but it's one thing to have that as a one scene, mysterious, here we are in the transporter pad, you know, conference. But if you're going to have that be a walking, talking, you see it every week, every day, alien amongst you, not the Shelyak per se, mm-hmm. but you want to have a really non-human, man, that's a practical production, you know. And when they did the Zindi shows and they had the insectoids and they had two of the stand-ins, I think Evan was one of them, but they had the stand-ins wearing the black, you know, almost like a motion capture, yeah. early version of a motion capture suit. I mean, you've got to go through the hoops of what that will look like in practicality to shoot with, even if you've got CGI at the wazoo and you can do it cheaply and all that. So anyway, when we talk about diversity in the cast and diversity in the casting, my mind doesn't just stop with, are they going to be white, black, brown, yellow, red, purple, pink? It's how about the planets that they're representing, yeah. not just humans. So We'll see. He promised more. And again, that makeup test picture, little tease, the unpainted Andorian head. Aaron and some of the rest of them said, how about a Glommer?
So the Glommer would be like an actual crew member that performs tasks around the ship?
Right. How does a Glommer survive when there are no tribbles around to gobble up? So, I don't know. But yeah, if you really want to have a diverse Federation, forget the damn humans. That's all I'm saying.
Well, Larry, I have really high hopes for robots in Discovery because I heard some news this morning that Brian Fuller has added a new writer to the team, Albert Macklin. And I think that Albert Macklin is going to do a fantastic job with stories that feature robots.
That, is he still around? Is he still writing?
He is still writing.
He was at his prime. He was doing, I mean, his, I guess, what, the 50s? Yeah. My God, it's been 50, 60 years since he was at his peak, right?
It's amazing. I think he's now the publisher of Incredible Tales, but he's still beating that robot drum.
Bongo, as it were. Yes, I saw your tweet. Very cute. You were fast on the trigger there.
That was the first thing that I thought of when I saw the news and I saw that comment about robots.
And I tried to serve this up a while ago, but you did it much better just then. Yeah, yes. Star Trek's other famous robot entry.
That's right.
Right.
Okay, so we talked about Amanda Grayson earlier and whether Spock's mother might be in the story. I saw somewhere someone mentioned that maybe Sarek can make an appearance. I mean, it would make sense in terms of the timeline, but it has to make sense for the story. But Brian Fuller also said that, again, this is after they get the show established, but over the run of Discovery, it's conceivable that Discovery could feature characters from TOS, maybe even bridge crew characters from TOS, but they're not focused on that right now. But if they decided to do that down the line, is it something you would like to see, and who would make sense for you?
Well, I mean, they all would make sense, but you know, it's that really is like what fanboy porn. I mean, I would really want them to go slow and careful. They would obviously have to be recast, cast anew. And no, it won't be anybody from the movies, from the Kelvin movies. We don't say JJ movies anymore or Altverse.
What if it's Kyle?
So there's a whole, you know, what if it's Mr. Leslie? What if it's Mr. Lemley? What if it's Ensign Gooseneck? I'm sorry, Mr. Hadley.
I want Bearclaw from the original series comics, because Bearclaw, he was always causing trouble. He was getting in fights in the corridors, and he was just sort of, he would add some excitement to the show, I think.
That's true. He was Native American?
He was, yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, what if we had like young Ensign, because when you said that, I immediately thought of Ensign Dawson Walking Bear from the Animateds, who was also but was not near so much a troublemaker. But then my mind went to the Animateds and I thought, well, there's Maress and and Eryx.
Yeah, of course.
What if we had somehow alive or CGified live or whatever, enhanced Edosian or Acacian?
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
That I would like to see.
That would be pretty wild.
Yeah,
but or any of those, but Yeah. Yeah. I just saying all the fame, the iconic, you know, regulars, I just would say go slow. Don't, you know, I mean, I don't know if he'll have someone to do a send off. It almost was a tradition there of all the pilots, the latter day pilots, you know, McCoy and Farpoint, and then the crossover Picard to DS9 and Quark and Voyager. And they did something of that having,
well, even in Enterprise, they had Zefram Cochrane.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Having Zefram Cochrane, a little bit there, older guy. And whether Brian is enough for traditionalist or it fits the story to have that happen somehow and who that would be, maybe that's, maybe Amanda Grayson is standing at a shuttle tram station and says one or two lines, the little boy, baby Spock with her and or not, he wouldn't be a baby then.
Well, he'd be quite, he'd still be quite old.
I'm thinking,
right?
He'd be Pike age. I was rambling there, but it'll be, I mean, there's a piece of me that thinks that Brian will have a nod. I have no idea, nothing to base this on. But again, I'm saying Brian is enough for a traditionalist and he knows the ways of Trek that I wonder if they found a way to work in a bridging launch type character into the story somehow, some way. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have nothing to base that on. I'm just thinking that he's enough to, or maybe they don't. Maybe it never comes up and he doesn't think about it. But I wouldn't be surprised if he pays homage to that latter day trend with a launch the ship character, came down to break the bottle over the bow.
Well, there are so many options that in that time period, there's so many things that you could do. So, yeah, I mean, you'd have
Young
to recast,
Harry
of course. That's the only thing you'd have to recast, but.
Well, right, obviously.
But if someone's a lot younger, then you could recast. I mean, it could be number one. Number one could give the assignment to the Discovery.
Right. And you know what? And we didn't even mention that. We were talking about the woman of, some people were saying, oh, look, it is Cade Set. And we're talking about number one is the woman lieutenant, commander. Blah, blah.
I don't think it's going to be
but
that.
But he did say he really wants to cast it as a person of color, which would wipe that out unless they're totally ignoring precedent, which I don't think he's about to do. No one wants to dishonor the memory of Majel playing number one.
No.
By
Well, I think so that's too obvious, too.
Very on the nose. Right. I think that's too close.
Yeah, I don't think they'll do something so obvious as that. So not with the character, not with the lead character. Okay.
And not with a ship named Discovery and not with a...
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the ship for a minute. So the ship is evolving. We all saw the teaser. And I have to say that I don't remember many things in fandom, and fans love to get upset about the things that they don't like, but I can't remember many things in Star Trek fandom in the recent years that had a more unanimous negative reaction than the design of the Discovery in that teaser.
And am I just getting senile, Chris? I don't get it. It's a nacelles and saucer ship with the secondary hull. What is everybody so freaking upset about? Now, some people were like, oh, it looks just like McCoy's ship from Planet of the Titans. Ooh. And it does, and that's interesting. And they even referenced that at Comic-Con when they unveiled it. And within 2 minutes, somebody was asking about it. And then he even came up with I'm sure there was some mad texting going back and forth. Maybe they were prepped to answer that. But I almost think maybe it caught somebody off guard. Like, you guys do know you're talking to Star Trek fans, and in the minute there's at least five people in this hall of 6,000 with at least one or two of them in the press gallery who are going to say, wow, that looks just like the McCoy ship. And then by the time, and then Scott Mance of all people jumping up at the press conference with the lead off question to say, did you mean for that to be the homage ship for the McCoy ship? And then Brian having to say, I might say more about this after I talk to the lawyers and we work the legal stuff out to say about it. But,
because my feeling was that it was.
I can't believe that was done in a vacuum. I can't believe that was done in a vacuum.
My feeling was that it was an homage. It never occurred to me that it was a coincidence. For me, it was them knowing Star Trek history, especially when you consider who all is involved in this writing team, and that in their mind, that was a nice way of taking part of Star Trek history and kind of connecting things, knowing that one potential design for the Enterprise heading into what eventually became the motion picture looked very similar to this. And you could say, well, this is a design trend within Starfleet at the time. And that's why that Enterprise was possibly going to look that way, but then it evolved into what we got. So if it was just a coincidence, that's kind of very surprising to me.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and it's a little clunkier. And to me, the fact that it fits in between Archer's NX-01 and Kirk's ship, I mean, it fits in there. And
makes sense.
No one is saying that this is 10 years for Kirk and it's a brand new ship off the assembly line.
Yeah.
I mean, if you went strictly by numbers-ish, you know, it's 1031. So if Enterprise is 1701, but then see again, Enterprise was launched in 2245. So it's not about the 60s or even the 50s. It's about the 40s for Enterprise's registry.
Well, and the Enterprise
wasn't. If we're allowed to be all anal about the numbers, then this is somewhere between, this is two-thirds of the way between Archer and April's Enterprise.
Yeah, right.
So it's from the 2220s or 30s. So, you know, in the original writer's guide for the original series, Gene said he wanted the Enterprise to be a ship with some age to it. He didn't say life. He basically said he didn't want to be a brand spanking new ship. He wanted to be a ship with some age on, mm-hmm. some years of it already. And, you know, and obviously they, since they went kind of with the Pike backstories that evolved, that came in handy. So this would be, again, I could see the Discovery. And again, we don't know. People are sitting here thinking of nice, you know, neatly tied up little bow, captain, first officer, blah, 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 crew. If I know Brian and I know his desire to tell a really good Star Trek story, but with the filter, with the veneer of something a little askew or out of the box or with some rough edges to it, right? I mean, if you thought DS9 was dark and gritty, you know, hold on to your hats, but not so in your face that people can't enjoy it. I don't think he's going to get radical. But again, not the gleaming new ship of the fleet. And that, I just now thought of that. 1701 comes from 2244 or 45. So you're really talking two thirds of the way from Archer to, so, you know, 2220s or 30s. So the clunkier design of the ship makes even more sense. And that means that if it's that old, that it's been around for 30 years. So I mean, just throwing that out there. I mean, as much as a lot of people, and I know Dayton Ward and a lot of people grew up and loved, Rick Sternbach and et al. That did the spaceflight chronology in 79 with the first batch of new pocketbooks books with the motion picture. When that came out, I could tell the whole thing was to be anti what had evolved to the fan timeline that had come along that Mike and Denise wound up fleshing out even more. But it was well on its way because that's what we were using with the original Star Trek maps that Jeff Mandel and the fan body had been coming up with and evolving. And I didn't like spaceflight chronology because they came up with the whole, they literally went with Khan was 200 years after, before Space Seat, without massaging mm-hmm. it. The way other data points and other facts, you could go with that one, but there were all these other facts that, no, we have to tender that. We have to say Kirk was massaging it for him or lying or whatever. But they went with a strictly 200 plus dating system for Space Seed after the Eugenics Wars. And then all the artwork, and Rick did it, and it's all great stuff. And the motion picture Enterprise was rendered wonderfully in the original series. But all the ships in that book, I never liked them. I'll just say that. I know a lot of the ship nerds love that book and love those designs. But I just thought the ship logs were melodramatic and the ships didn't seem to follow any kind of flow. Really.
Like a design pattern that you would normally have.
A design pattern, yeah. A natural evolution.
Yeah, natural evolution, yeah.
And so when I saw the Discovery, to me, it fit much easier into that design flow evolution than, say, all the ships, some of them beloved by fans from that era, of the spaceflight chronology. I mean, it's like if you really wanted to see clunky ships that don't seem to have a pattern, there's your answer. And again, I love everybody that loves that book and love the book, and I know Rick did it according to the dictates of the day. But, you know, that's what I'm saying. So I'm carrying that conversation. I just, the whole uproar over that ship just baffles me.
Well, the other thing, I think that because we forget, because we're older, that the majority of the fan base is a lot younger than we are, and many of them are completely unaware of McQuarrie's design that led up to the motion picture. And so right. For them,
much less the book Spaceflight Chronology.
Yes, right. But for them, this was just a ship. Like, oh, here's a new ship design. What on earth are they thinking? Yeah. And they don't even know that there was this other ship that looked almost just like this that was being developed for the whole Phase 2 Planet of the Titans motion picture time period leading up to that. And, you know, a number of people have brought that up. Our art director, Aaron Harvey, did a quick little special on his show, Saturday mm-hmm. Morning Trek, about that. And that was great. I saw a funny thing on Twitter or Facebook. I don't remember where it was, but someone had taken a picture of a Klingon battlecruiser coming up behind the Enterprise. And they had captioned it like, "Hey, what you doing? You want to get together?" And then it had 9 months later, and it had the Discovery.
The Discovery was the bastard child because of a Constitution and a D7.
It does look a bit like if you take the back side of a D7 and then you put a Starfleet saucer section on the front of it. It does look a little bit like that.
Let's leave the back side of a D7 alone.
That's not going to be the show title, Larry.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, really the only thing, it's nacelles, it's a saucer, and the secondary hull is flat and triangular. I just,
it's,
you know,
the flat triangular secondary hull part that feels weird to people, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, the structural, I mean, to me, I don't want to say upset, but I was more weirded out by the shape of the NX-01. Mm. And then I found out, you know, and then as the years went by and found out that they were indeed actually trying to do a lineage out of the DYs and evolve it through that. And it wound up, they just being told, you know, I think Doug is responsible for the design there. And he took a lot of heat in the beginning. Well, it look like it's going to lead into the Enterprise Kirk ship. What the hell are you doing there, Doug? But he was doing, you know, what the producers were having him do. And he had his own design ideas. And then, you know, came up with the idea of the refit later that's made so many people thrilled, and which does bring it back or establish the beginnings of the lineage.
Yeah,
of the
it
design
shows
flow.
The design concept and how it would gradually become that.
And to the point that it's so accepted, there's model kits and it's in the Eagle Moss line, which is all awesome
did
stuff.
A great one. So, well, okay, yeah, so but so we've talked.
But I think this could be in that flow as they're trying different things, and you know, it's obvious. And if it's a ship that's been around for 30 years, it's obviously whatever we think of it. It's obviously going to be established as a design that's worked.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so second only to the Bird of Prey and the Excelsior class.
That's right. And the Miranda class. We see a lot of those as well. Okay, Larry. So now that we've talked all about this, Fuller has said that the ship design has changed a bit since that teaser was mm-hmm. done. So what do you think they might be doing to the ship? And do you think that any of it is in response to fan reaction?
Well, I think that we were just talking about the triangular secondary hull. I'm sure that by now is an octagon, to match, you know, the Matt Jeffries octagonal doors, you know, just like my Portal 47 logo. I'm sure they're just experimenting with how many sides they can add to the basic geometric shape that the secondary hull will be. I'm kidding. You do know I'm kidding, Chris.
Well, I can see. I'm just picturing, you know, with computers, they can do as many options as they want. And I'm just picturing what they might be coming up with. Maybe
and
some of those.
And there's a... And there's a hangar deck coming out of every side.
That's right. No. Just back your ship up here. We'll have a party on the Discovery tonight.
Right.
I can just
right.
see, you know, some sides are extending into other dimensions, even. You don't even know what's happening with the ship.
No, anymore. I did hear Heather Caden, I think some people picked it up, at the press conference at Comic-Con San Diego after the teaser and after the big panel. It was so sad. I just want to say this. The panel was meant to celebrate 50 years. You know, the panel at Comic-Con was meant to give Star Trek a Hall H moment, which they had once before when JJ announced they brought in, you know, the first person cast was Zachary Quinto, which made so much sense because he looked so much like, you know, who else is going to, in the current crop of people, was going to play Spock. And then the thing that brought down the house, you know, now with some pathos to it now, is when they brought Leonard out, and that was a shock and melted down there. But that was at least a new movie coming. And my God, that was 07, right? That was 07 because Star Trek, the old Star Trek.com team was still together. We were covering it. But other than that, that was a new tangent of Star Trek. But Prime Star Trek, which again, Brian is making every effort to basically be the fifth spinoff series without any hiccups or any worries by anybody. Trust me, folks. Star Trek, you know, preceded all the hallowed days, the apex days of Next Generation, and all of that was all in the movie era, the 80s movies. That was all way before, you know, the Comic-Con generation and Hall H, which seems like it's been around forever, but it's really only been the late aughts, right? Mm. And since Hollywood invaded comics, and that's why it exploded in the first place. So all, even the spinoff, even Enterprise and Voyager, they never had a chance to have a Hall H moment and have 6,000 screaming Comic-Con people melt them down on the pop culture that was being carried as mainstream news by mainstream news outlets. That was all It was nice to see, and I know CBS and our friends at licensing there, John and Bill and all of them, worked really hard to create a lot of those Star Trek moments at Comic-Con, which, by the way, it was the biggest Star Trek footprint ever seen there because of that. Star Trek really did precede the Comic-Con wave. So it was great they had that, and the panel was set up to celebrate the 50 years. And it was cool to see Shatner and Scott and Michael Dorn and Brand and Jerry Ryan all up there together. But you know the heartbeat, the tension line of the room was all about Brian up there, who was ostensibly the moderator. But all anybody wanted to do was pepper him with the questions. The star power was enough that assembled cast of actors, you know, was attracting when they did open it up to Q&A and they were dividing things up. Obviously, people were just thrilled to have them there and have them on the big stage. But I know once we got back, especially got back to the press conference, Some of the Europeans and some of the mainstream people were throwing things at Shatner and Jerry and all of them. But the real tension in the room, people just wanted to tie up Brian and give him, you know, a truth serum. And
he's going to reveal everything.
Have him spout new stuff. Yes. The only thing new on that stage, new and scary and thrilling and exciting and secret, was everything in Brian's brain. So in search of, you know, Brian's brain was where everybody was going. And they did leave out a few crumbs. But the upshot of this was Heather Caden, the producer partner, was there. And either off the cuff or maybe directly to a question, she talked about, and I really am circling back to the ship design, she talked about how they crammed that feature, that little ship trailer, how the CG people they had brought in or whatever literally did that like in the last week. It's like whatever the evolution of the ship was, it's like they froze it right there to do a thing for Comic-Con, you know, a little 2-minute bit for Comic-Con. And they said, expect it to keep going on. I'm sorry, if this was a month later, it would have looked different. If it was a month earlier, it would have looked different. But you just caught us in our early evolution. So that was interesting. That and the fact that they had to stop what they were doing and do a snapshot of it at that moment and crank it out. So for everybody to think, oh, that's set in stone, it's 6 months out and yeah, it's going to keep evolving. And maybe we'll even get to a decadahedron or something by that time. I don't know.
Interesting. Well, the last thing on our list that we haven't talked about is related to this in a way, and it's the overall aesthetic of the show. So Brian Fuller has said that we can play with all the iconography of those ships and those uniforms. And they, of course, want to, I believe, capture...
Of the Kirk era.
Of the Kirk era, right. And capture the feeling of the original series. But, of course, they also understand that they have to make it work for an audience in 2017. So when Enterprise updated its look, it created something that felt more real to us in the 2000s when that was made at the beginning of that decade, because the original series look, it just wouldn't have worked on television in my opinion. And I think that's still true now, but what do you expect to see? Do you think that they'll find a way to capture that 60s feel with a modern twist instead of just going in some completely other direction and therefore create an aesthetic that maybe fans will be a little bit warmer to?
Well, again, Brian is not just a fanboy, but he's a smart guy. And yeah, Enterprise, and I understood that. And I had some disappointments there, but I also knew what they were going. They were going for a submarine look.
Right.
And they actually, on Enterprise, well, and they actually went down and visited submarines.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, they're really trying to bridge halfway between NASA and Kirk.
Yeah.
Really. or, you know, April Kirk. And now this ship is going to be midway between Archer and Archer and Kirk. So it can be clunkier. I thought the Franklin was, I mean, like the Franklin did a pretty good job in Beyond. I'm not trying to mix apples and oranges here too much. The Franklin was supposed to be an old ship from even before Archer's time, a warp 4, not a warp 5. The worst thing about the Franklin, I thought, as far as we're talking about design motifs, was it looked to me more like a motion picture set than a bridge because it had, you'd watch the action and there'd be like this immense space around them. If it was really a ship older than Archer's, it would have been more cramped. That was the big disappointment with me. The motifs and the looks of it, I thought were fine. It's just when you stopped and realized that there was like, they're like standing in a huge bridge and a huge, there's all this empty space around them. There'd be a console and then 100 feet and then the next console. No, I'm kidding. But it felt that way when you stopped and looked behind the actors. And I don't see Brannon and the team he puts together doing that same kind of thing.
Are you expecting it to be really colorful? I get the feeling that they're going to try to go back to the original series colorful kind of look in terms of the uniforms and all.
Yeah, when he says play with that iconography, I think you know, but Brian has his real whimsical side, and I can't wait to talk to Brian about why, of all the times they could go to, okay, you made the decision to go Prime. Thank you. That's cool. Now, here's all, as we said for years, here are all the corners of the Roddenberry Star Trek sandbox you could go investigate, you could play with. And they all have their pluses and minuses. And I can't wait to ask him why then. And if that was totally the first dart they threw, or if they came up with the kind of story they wanted to do and that seemed to fit it. Or, you know, whatever led what. But I know that he'll enjoy playing with that. And, you know, it's a bit, even though we've had the Pike era, we've seen them on screen. I think it's more about recreating them, maybe not slavishly, but recreating that look and that feel without deviating too much. But again, bringing in all the best that they could. I mean, you know, the Kelvin itself is supposed to be older than the Enterprise, and they had all the nice 2009 crazy CGI overlays of graphics and, you know, info overload that was available to the crew there on the bridge. And I just keep thinking that when we see the cage and we saw Pike's Enterprise bridge, that they just had everything and they were just kind of in between missions and they had everything turned off.
That's it. With power saver mode, they were.
Yeah, and they didn't need the 5,000 layer holographic imaging monitor screen mode on, whereas they were in a crisis mode and needed it all. So, you know, with the choices they'll make design wise, because, you know, people talk about canon. There's, to me, it's always been concept canon and visual canon, and one can be great, one can be not so great. So I'm totally thrilled about the concept canon. I'm thinking that the visual canon won't be so far behind, even with the temptation. I mean, I don't say false choice, but the whole thing of Enterprise was, we can't do plywood and Christmas lights again, like the 60s. We can't, you know, how do we predate that? Well, the point is that you have advanced production and materials and technology available for your visual factor, your visual design. But the point is that you've got so much more sophisticated. It's not just that you have advanced techniques, but you have a sophistication. So you should be able to make choices. It should be easy for you to mimic 30-year-old technology, but with a higher degree. I mean, the decisions and the explanation for the ships and trials and tribulations. Greg Jean rebuilt an Enterprise and a K-7 and a D-7, which we never saw in the original Tribbles. And they made them to a degree that would stand up under close camera work way better than anything in the 60s was. They used a little AMT model kit for the Enterprise orbiting K-7. And K-7 was simple. And they didn't even show a Klingon. The conceit was that we're pushing in on these models to look modern. And if you're upset that there's more detail on the models, especially K-7, my God, the explanation was, well, our point of view in the 60s was so far back that we weren't close enough to see these details. Mm-hmm. But they were really always there. Mm-hmm. We just couldn't get close enough to see them, you know, or if they could have done this in the 60s, this is what they would have done. But once you pull back from the model, supposedly the way it was filmed, it doesn't look any different than it did in the 60s. So that kind of conceit Like, the only reason you didn't see this level or this level of detail is because we're talking about the, see, that's how I think you can take the modern paradigm and play with it and come out the winner. You don't have to be a slave. Oh my God, we're so advanced. We're just helpless. That makes no sense. The fact that you have all these advanced techniques and materials should make it easy for you to play with, to play with that and come up with ways to master the craft of looking like you could be the same era, but you found ways to insert all the coolness that you can bring to it because of your time of creation.
But you have to find anyway, a way to do it so that the audience buys into it and not just us as Star Trek fans who grew up with the original series, but a new audience as well who is accustomed to technology that looks more realistic and looks like what we have now.
Oh, we don't care about them, Chris. We don't care. Who needs them? Who needs them?
Because, you know, I
guess CBS needs them to keep it going.
Yeah, I know people who won't watch the original series because the tech of the series, for example, is just too clunky and it just seems so dated that they can't really believe that that's set in the future. And so I think you have to find a way to capture that feeling of what the bridge, what the interior of the ships looked like in the original series, but then merge that with an aesthetic that feels real and natural to us now, which is not what Enterprise did. And I love what Enterprise did. I actually think that their sets look beautiful and the bridge looks beautiful. It just doesn't, it feels much closer to NASA than, it's like exactly. They were really close to NASA and they didn't actually take those steps towards Kirk's era. And in this case, they would have to obviously move much closer to Kirk's era.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, and going back to the original, when Matt Jeffries and even Pato Guzman, I guess, but when Gene was getting his vision across visually and conceptually and you know, it, with models and with the sets, the paradigm that they had, they didn't have much money and they were overspending what little they did have. That was a limiting factor. Whereas Irwin Allen, I know on Lost in Space, they were just throwing tons of money at the standing sets of the Jupiter 2, you know, and all the, you know, Nick Meyer would call them the blinkies. And so you have, so now you look at that and it looks like such a dated 60s. Oh, it's a computer. And you know, it's a computer because there's rows and rows and rows. There's hundreds of blinky lights, you know, and they didn't have the money to do that on Star Trek. It was partly a design choice, but they couldn't have done it even if they'd wanted to. And years later, that, you know, and Mike Kuder will talk about this too, that restraint, invention is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. Mm-hmm. Well, you could make that into TV design and have it be budget limit or whatever. But, you know, the restraints that they worked under, they'd probably curse them every day. But those restraints are what gave you that spare minimal look. But what they came to decide was, rather than show or having a gash in the wall and having tons of pipes and everything, you know, having the less expensive path that they had to take. Oh, that's just plywood sets and Christmas lights. But if you take a step back with that, the acting and the stories treated it with such respect that after a while, no one thought that. Mm-hmm. It was only, you know, as the years went by, we saw what could happen. But those actors and those writers and directors and craftspeople made those sets believable. I mean, there's never been a universe before or since, maybe Star Wars, maybe Firefly, but at the time, pioneering, that brought you in. You know, Gene would say that we have to make the environment as believable as our characters, or else no one's going to believe that they're really out on the ship. So all the talk about canon and believability and all that started, I've waxed on this before too. It started with them respecting the audience, knowing that everything, every aspect had to be believable. And operating under the budgets they had to operate with and time constraints, that made that even an even higher bar. And the result is we call them iconic now, right? Mm-hmm. They're cherished, they're celebrated. And even in the time though, if not the execution, the design itself, like the circular bridge design, Captain Middle, I mean, you know, the defense policy think tanks that would come in and talk to Matt Jeffries and them in the time. And even later on would come, and Herman has talked about, you know, that same thing happening still. And he designed a rough conceptual, one aspect of the military he's talked about came to him and he got hired to do some conceptualizing for some military control centers. But that shines through whatever the surface features are. But what I'm trying to say is the beauty of the original series with those limits led to a sleekness that, rather than be a liability and looking cheap and underfunded, is turned around. They even came up with this eventually, but it is turned around into a strength. No. We are so cool and we are so powerful that you don't even see all the innards. You don't see all the controls. The ship hull is sleek. We don't, you know, we're so much better than clunky, you know, connection lines and joints and gaps inside and out. And it, they turned that into a show of strength. And then when Mike McMaster, I mean, I used to, you know, when you're a kid, you're going, where are the labels on the buttons on the bridge? But Mike McMaster made that a strength and came up with the idea that all of those are pre-programmable or reprogrammable multifunction consoles. Right. And that somewhere in the console is a, you know, so this overlay is this, this overlay is slightly different at each station. So when you start factoring that in, and then Mike brought that into the touch controls too. Yep. I mean, that's part of the touch controls there. So anyway, you take those liabilities, make them strengths. And if you're so advanced with all your techniques and your know-how, then that's the creative challenge. It's just like the writers talking about, oh my God, Canon is a rock around my neck. I can't do with that. I need total freedom and a total blank slate. It's like, no, that's part of the creative challenge, is to acquaint yourself with that universe and go plunge in and don't be afraid of it. Very little in this universe, very little on this earth has a background to it that Star Trek does. And to run away from it conceptually, visually, or textually, is such a shame. And that's what we kid about canonistas, and I do too, but I am one. And that's one of the C's by five C's of Star Trek. That's what makes it so cool. So I'm trusting again. This is maybe the diciest thing of all, and maybe I'll be disappointed in a few ways, but I'll get over it. But I'm trusting in Brian to enforce that. If we're so damn advanced, let's see how creative we can be in making something that fits visually.
Yeah. That ties
and I'm
to
sorry
the
to get off
series.
On a soapbox, but
well, no,
I just,
that's
you know,
a great point, and something I think people don't think about with the original series, especially today when you look back at it. People know that the ship itself is iconic, but
I thought one of the hallmarks of Enterprise and one of the proudest moments was when they went back and did the, you know, it was the Defiant. But here's Mr. High Def television series, especially the fourth season, using those 60 sets and lighting them. And having people in those costumes and those uniforms on it again, with a little bit of the tweak, you know, Mike and Jim Vanover, they put just a little bit of motion into those static overhead screens, and again, they did the conceit of, well, here's just a little bit more that we can do now without ruining the overall image, and they looked fabulous. And I remember thinking, watching that show, going, so much for your cheap plywood and Christmas light sets here, Bucky. These look pretty damn awesome, and they looked inherently powerful, you know, like. We're so cool, we don't have to show it on the surface. And that's the attitude. So we'll see. I hope they can pull that off. I hope they go for that direction.
As you describe this, I'm picturing that for the next iPhone, instead of having Johnny Ive describe the design process, I want to have you describe the design process. We don't have to show any of the seams. This phone is so powerful, we don't need to show it on the surface.
Right. Yeah, just touch it to your forehead and it'll do whatever you want. Yeah.
And also, Larry, you mentioned Lost in Space. That's one robot that we forgot to mention earlier when we were talking about possible robots.
I almost said that popped into my head to have. Yeah, I want to. I think if Brian is really going to tweak people and be Mr. Fanboy, you know, he did the Munsters reboot pilot that didn't sell, but I just want to. He can be Mr. 60s, you know, cheesy. What's the word I want to say? Yeah. I just think they need a, if they have a robot, I would just love to have it occasionally say that does not compute. That would be
what I want. Is I want to have a scene happening on the bridge. They're heading into a tough situation. Maybe an alien ship is coming up or something. And the captain says, go to red alert. And then the camera quickly pans over to the other side of the bridge. And that robot is going, danger, danger. With its arms flailing all around.
I think they should have a character named Rob Willerson, and he can say danger, Rob Willerson. I don't know because you know you can't
danger, danger, Rob Willerson. That way they won't get sued, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's your title for the episode here tonight.
Danger, Rob Willerson. That's excellent.
Yeah, danger, Rob Willerson.
All right, Larry. Well, I think we've run down all the news that we have so far. I'm sure we'll do another one
of these. We've run down something. I don't know if it's the news, it's but something. We've sure run down something.
We'll do another one of these eventually when we have more information, probably after they do some casting and such. But it's been fun. Let us know if you're listening, what you think about all the things that we touched on here. The best place to do that is in the Babel Conference on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right on up. It is a closed group, so if you're not a member yet, you'll need to click join, and we'll let you on in. If you're on Twitter, our username is TrekFM. You can send us an email by going to trek.fm/contact, and that'll come to me by email. Or send us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/TrekFM. So Larry, what else do you have going on right now? Where can people find you and keep up with your world tour, I guess, is going on still, right?
It feels like it. It's all been pretty much limited to the States. No, we got through the summer of, I called it 5-0 fever. So, you know, all the big conventions are pretty much over. I won't be at Mission New York, but I'm going to be at Salt Lake Comic Con and even Pensacola Comic Con here in a couple of weeks. And a few more things coming down the road that are getting shaped up. I'm going to be at libraries across central Michigan the third week of September around Detroit. So look for that. I'm really excited because my website is in the middle of finally, after its pioneering 2008 look, is going to be blossoming and look like it's part of this century. And the first page that we modernized was the newest one. It's kind of like bringing Enterprise out on Blu-rays because you can.
That's the easiest.
The portal47.net page is nicely new, and this has been getting a lot of kudos. So thank you to my web guy, Parker Bennett. And the rest of the site will look that way too very soon. So yay, Portal 47. We've been picking up new members for that all over the place. Our deep dive from my insider's assets. And that's exciting. And we had our first live dive at Vegas with about 10 members who were there at Vegas. And we did charter member t-shirts for the charter members. So I'm going to be having a launch, a first anniversary launch call for Portal 47. So I'll post that over on, if that's okay, it'll be on all my Facebooks and my sites and my existing mail list, but I'll drop that around the internet at places like Trek FM maybe, and maybe the Babel Conference, and just let people know to be on that call. We'll have a special guest and everybody can come in and see how the portal works. And that'll be right around the Star Trek anniversary, which is also right around the portal anniversary officially. So that week of the 8th, 9th, and through there somewhere. So be watching for that. Otherwise, the Con of Wrath, we're trying to wrap that up. So maybe some exciting new announcements there coming out of people I talked to at Vegas. So yeah, I thought I'd have a breather after Vegas, and I realized that no, it's still going. I'm just glad I had enough voice to hop on tonight. And yep. It's going to be going all through the winter, and I can't wait to get into it. And knowing that it's not, you know, I said months ago, will this just be a hangover in 2017? Thanks to Brian, and I'm sorry guys, it really is going to be exciting. Star Trek Discovery is going to keep us from having a hangover year in 2017, and people will hopefully be just as excited. The cosplay will be all over the map, just as it was this year at the cons. The debates, the discussions. You kids that don't know what it's like to have weekly Star Trek are just going to be blown over. And now we have the whole layer of social media, and I'm sure there'll be an after talk show and all of that bringing to it. Old and new fan alike, it's going to be a whole new world and exciting. And I'm just so glad we're out of the desert. And
It is going to be. And I already checked on Japanese Netflix, and Star Trek Discovery is there. Obviously, there's nothing to watch.
I saw you posting, yes.
But it's there.
That's it.
And other people from around the world have been posting in the Babel Conference as well, showing their screenshots. So it's out there. We don't have any other Star Trek on Japanese Netflix yet, except for 2009 and Into Darkness. But according to CBS, by the end of the year, we're supposed to have everything, all six.
And you know, we didn't talk about the whole financial. They actually did talk about some of the financial ramifications at the TCA, and got into a little bit more about that. Yeah, let's mention this real quick. It was really interesting talking about the woman of color, woman lead character, because CBS on the network side was getting criticized after all this diversity casting.
Yeah.
And the movies and TV world and all the with the Emmys and the Oscars, especially the Oscars this year, I forget all the hashtags about how it's all, you know, white guys and how CBS was getting criticized for most of their fall lineup is heavy on white guys, that here's Star Trek once again, that is a little bit out of the radar because the mainstream TV press is all concerned with the network. But here's Star Trek. That's why some of this debate in aw shucksness is it gets to me, because here's Star Trek being pioneering again. And here's the mainstream media jumping on mainstream CBS for doing that. But anyway, I think I saw somewhere where Les Moonves said the show was the international income alone is just about paid for the show already for the first season.
Yeah, I heard he said it was already profitable. So
Yeah. So all those foreign countries that were worried about how they would see it, and all I thought was, you're going to see it, guys. Yeah. They want every penny out of you.
Well,
and we've seen that pretty much, yeah, you know, come to fruition.
And that's a topic for another show, because it could be a big discussion. But I am glad that they made, except for Canada, which has its own thing, that they made one deal for the entire world.
Yes.
Because I was really concerned they were going to try to do individual deals with local distributors, and that would have been a nightmare.
That would have been a killer patchwork. Yeah. So I'm sure on both sides of the aisle on that one, it's going to be easier. So yeah, I should have said also, of course, you could also get me at Larry Nemechek's Trekland or at Larry Nemechek on Twitter.
Exactly. All right. Well, if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, and C. Brian Jones is my username pretty much everywhere. You can find my writing about Star Trek over on the official website at StarTrek.com. And then here on the network, you can also find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, which is all about Deep Space Nine. I'd also like to take a moment here to thank my associate producers on The Ready Room: Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, K. Elizabeth Janeway, and Tim Robertson. It's thanks to all of these people that I'm able to bring The Ready Room to you every week, and that we're able to keep the network going as well. So thank you, Renee, Zachary, Sam, Kay, and Tim, for all of your support. If you'd like to support what we're doing here on The Ready Room and the network, you can do that at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. Just go over there. You'll find out everything you need to know about how to support the network. Every little bit does help. It costs a lot of money to operate this network, and we do need your support to keep it all going. And if you'd like to become an associate producer on The Ready Room, you can do that there as well. And also, if you want to talk Star Trek with other patrons as well as other hosts from the network, you can do that through Patreon also, because we have the Roundtable where you can get on mic, you can hop in a meeting just like Larry and I are right now, and talk Trek with others. Again, patreon.com/trekfm is the place to go, and I really thank everyone so much for your support. Well, all right, Larry, that's it for this special Ready Room. Everyone will be back next time with a normal episode where we have a new segment and a feature, and that feature, if you want to watch it ahead of time, is going to be TNG's Justice. So, Larry, I think I'm going to go run around a bit, because, you know, that's what you have to do on Justice. They run everywhere, the Edo, they're big runners.
I was just on Rubicon 3. The tour went there. It was right across the pond from Starfleet headquarters.
Did you see people running by, and did you see other people out in the corner and doing all kinds of inappropriate things?
Yeah. And how those little white scraps of clothing stayed so clean. I was just amazed.
It is amazing. Well, I'm going to go wash mine right now. I'll make sure that it's sparkly white.
Well, you go do that. But otherwise, you know what, Chris? It's time to stick a triangular secondary hull in it with a hangar bay on every corner, because the Ready Room is done.